Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
The Athletic.
Hello, and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast.
Are you recording?
I'm Joe Devine. This is what we do today. Oh no, first we have to intro people. So first, Ruben, the baby boy Pinder, hello. And also, John McKenzie. Today we spoke about, I'm bored of this, how do you do this for the whole
episode? This would also make sense to people when they hear it at the start of the podcast.
Very true.
So let's do it.
Yeah. I think it's quite fun, isn't it?
Yeah, but again, it would make no sense at the start of the show.
It doesn't matter if it makes sense, does it?
I think it does. I think you have to, this is an example.
Hello,
you have to
and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine, and I enjoy to interrupt Steve Hanke, the producer of this podcast, which is the TIFO Football Podcast, when he's talking. Which is delightful for me because I can interrupt him to introduce two fabulous guests that we have here today. One of them an animal and one of them a baby. It is Jonathan Dog McKenzie. There he is. Look at him go. His delightful little woof there. And of course, Google Gaga, it's Ruben, the baby boy Pinder.
A gaga goo goo.
Yes. Thank you. Oh, look at that. He's really getting to the spirit of things now, isn't he? Five shows left to go and we've got a couple of googles and gagas. Now, the second live show, 6th of June, already sold out. If you wanted to get a ticket, you weren't fast enough, unless you did get one, in which case you were fast enough. Congratulations either way, and that's the end of it now. We'll see you on the 6th and the 7th of June, and afterwards, forevermore, in the form of Jonathan Dog McKenzie and his interviews. Very exciting stuff, yes. Now, let me tell you about what's coming up today, because there's so much on the agenda, isn't there, today? So much to get through. We've recorded for a long time. Steve has a big job to cut it all down. All those boring anecdotes we told. Yeah. All the bits about what did we say? What
was you it? Know we said pacey intro.
Pacey intro. I know, yeah. That's why I'm deliberately going slowly to bother you. The race for the top four. Yeah, very exciting. Who will win it? We're going to find out today. We're not, but we're going to talk about it. The thick, the rich, and buttery taste. Of Mrs. Buttersworth syrup. Okay, I wonder where that sentence was going. That's fun. The fragments of John McKenzie's heart that belong in Marcelo Bielsa's bucket. We get to that a bit later on. Arsenal living the game against Newcastle. That was a fun game. That was a very interesting game over the weekend. We talked about that one. Can you be chased in a fun way? I think yes, but we'll come on to discuss. Now, Gary O'Neill and Bournemouth. He's done well, hasn't he? So we talked about him. And, of course, a very comprehensive summary of the situation in League One, which is neither comprehensive nor really a summary, you know. So, but we'll get to that later on, right at the very end, if you stick around and you're special. We learn all the nicknames of the clubs down there, don't we? The Trees, was that one of them? The Trees?
Tricky Trees is Forest. It was the Cobblers, wasn't it?
The Cobblers, the Shoe People. That's right, yes. Shoe People. Now, if you like to keep your feet protected and warm, then you should visit The Athletic. Visit theathletic.com/TIFO, theathletic.com/TIFO, where not only the information that you will garner from these exceptionally well-written pieces, but also the way in which they are written, give you the feeling as though your soul is extra protected from the floor when you're walking on a pebbly beach. Now, visit theathletic.com/TIFO to find out more about how you can get a 30-day free trial to find out more. Yeah, that's theathletic.com/TIFO. Is that everything covered?
Warm hands, cool embrace. Bish, bash, bosh.
I will leave you now on the warm hands and the cool embrace of a very dour looking Jonathan McKenzie. Let's get a little close up of his face there. There he is. Yeah. Look at the camera. Look at the camera over here. Over here. Have a look just at this one here.
I want to go home, Joe.
Okay, well, you've got an hour and 40 minutes of podcasting to do now.
Thank you.
are going to talk about football, but before we do that, we thought when, John, you went to the toilet, Ruben was looking at your computer when I walked into the room, but only what was left up on the front there, wasn't it? What did you see, Ruben?
I saw a virtual queue for tickets to something at Wembley.
A virtual queue. So we thought we'd try and guess what it was that you were going to see at Wembley, assuming that it's not the Vanarama National League promotion final. Okay, silent. It could be. What do you think? We've seen the events. What do you think?
My money is on Harry Styles.
Harry Styles. I mean, Harry Styles, not just Harry Styles. Harry Styles, Love on Tour, which, you know, there's hospitality tickets available as well on the 14th of June. This isn't an advert, but are you buying those? Don't tell us yet.
No, I'm not.
Just say no.
I'm not buying those. Harry Styles grew up very near me, actually.
Did he?
Yeah, he grew up in a place called Holmes Chapel, I believe, which is about 5 miles away from where my parents currently live.
And it's impossible to say who's achieved more.
Yeah,
I agree with that. Yeah, because on the one hand, you would think obviously Harry Styles is an incredible musician, songwriter, world famous celebrity, you know, very, very wealthy. By all the modern metrics of success, he's got it. But he didn't start with the disadvantages that someone like John McKenzie did. Where, come on, look at John and listen to John. He's not a natural performer. He's not someone that's interesting or that you would really want to spend any time with, or someone that you even really, let's be honest, want to be around on a daily basis. So that he's managed to claw his way to where he is now is more impressive.
Please remain subscribed to the podcast for his new show next season.
Good point. Yeah, God, how's he doing it?
I've done a lot with a little. I think it's fair to
say. Are you going to see Def Leppard and Motley Crue, the world tour?
I'm not. No.
Are you going to see the All Elite AEW wrestling?
No.
I can't imagine what else it is on this list. Is it England, Australia? Is it something? Is it football?
It's the thing that you mentioned at the beginning.
Is it really in a queue for the Vanarama National League promotion final?
Yes.
There are 7,500 people ahead of you in the queue for that.
6,735 right now.
Wow. Okay. There we go. So by all rights, you'll get to buy a ticket by the end of the show. Keep us updated on that.
Yeah, it's still saying more than an hour, so let's see how long the show goes on for.
Sometimes they go on for a long time, don't they?
They do.
If anything, it's quite a good indication. If you get tickets in this show, but the show's only 50 minutes, it's because Steve's really cut it down.
I'm actually worried that I might miss the actual
final. Yeah, I was
going
to say it'd be quite funny if you were just like so in the zone midpoint that they all just went when you got to the front of the queue.
Who's it
between? I do want you to get a ticket, though.
It's Notts County versus... actually, I don't know who they're playing, but it was one of Chesterfield or Bromley. I didn't actually catch you.
You didn't pay attention. But you're a fan of Notts County, aren't you?
Yeah, one of my best friends works for the club, so I've been following them quite closely this season. So it's been great seeing them do well. They had a really exciting game yesterday, which was very exhausting. So they went 2-0 down in the first half, came back, scored in the 90+7 minutes to level it up, and then scored right at the end of extra time to go ahead. So yeah,
there's a lovely clip of the two, I assume, the Notts County commentary team.
That was
delightful to watch, if you can dig that out. Notts County, of course, for unfamiliar listeners, the team that pushed Wrexham all the way in
we watched that game between those two teams in the pub, and John was celebrating Notts County's goals as if they were, I don't know, I was going to say Leeds goals, but I think with more
excitement. There's arguments to be made that I have more at stake in this game than any Leeds game this season, which is a sad indictment of how...
Particularly Leeds when Leeds may get relegated.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, fine. Yeah. Well, listen, lots to discuss today. Where else to begin, I think, but with the race for top four? Because things really hotted up over the weekend, and Liverpool have sort of slunk out of nowhere a little bit. Currently... in fifth place, 35 games played, 62 points. Manchester United, of course, losing to West Ham late on Sunday night, are just ahead of them with one fewer game played, but only 1 point more. Liverpool in with a real shout now of finishing in the top four. Let's start with that game, though. West Ham United 1-0 Manchester United, John. Now, a lot of the conversation has been around De Gea, so we thought we'd talk about that as well. But just to get us started... I assume, I didn't watch this, but Manchester United were poor, I imagine.
It's a conversation that we've had throughout the season, I think. And one of the big questions that I've had around Manchester United really being able to compete at the top level is their ability to control games. And I think this was another good example of a game where they just don't have the ability to possess the ball, build up from the back in and restrict the opposition from being able to have the ball as well. So it just became a bit transitional, a bit end-to-end. And obviously that suits Manchester United largely because they do have good players who can perform in those ways. But Marcus Rashford, they're sort of relying on Marcus Rashford scoring goals. And obviously there was that a long period at the beginning of the season where he had that purple patch where he was putting goals in every game.
Then he was injured.
Yeah,
and came back and hasn't really picked up again.
So I guess, you know, obviously when things are going well, it's very easy to be like, oh, everything's fine. I can't ever see this run coming to an end. But I think there were signs even back then that they were reliant on certain individuals. Obviously, Martinez is not available anymore as well, which impacts their ability to build up from the back as well. So at the moment, we've gone from Manchester United going through that early spell in January, where I think they won something like 8 on the trot, and it looked like they were never going to lose again, to them going into games where you're looking at them thinking,
yeah,
are they going to come through this all right?
Well, of the last 5, they've won 2, drawn 1, and lost 2. So, I mean, they've dropped a fair number of potential points around there, which is what's one of the things that's let Liverpool back into the title race. Worth saying also, Tottenham have really stacked it. 5 points behind Liverpool, same number of games played. I mean, they're completely out of the race now. That would have been perhaps a bit more unthinkable, 10, 20 games ago. That did not seem like a realistic proposition. So that's been fun. Let's talk about De Gea, though. And again, we have discussed this before. We spent quite a lot of time at the beginning of the season talking about it, particularly around those Brighton and Brentford games early on for Manchester United, where they shipped a lot of goals trying to play it out from the back. There's an argument that despite, how good of a performer De Gea has been historically for the team and how good he is at shot stopping, he's not really the sort of goalkeeper that a Ten Hag Manchester United would ideally have.
Yeah, this is a conversation which seems to just get trotted out all the time, right, about the importance of build-up. Why is it that elite teams always want to build up from the back? And I think the reason why people often will argue about it is because it's not something that's necessarily tangible to you when you're looking at it. Whenever you see teams building up from the back, it often will look quite scary. It looks as though you're putting yourself under an undue amount of pressure. When you see the conditions presented like that, you think, why are we doing this? Why not just get the ball long? That's what you want to do. And it's one of those things where you just simply have to have the patience and belief that the statistical evidence backs it up. Manchester United have David De Gea and are not able to build up from the back. And so it results in what I was talking about before, which is a lack of ability to control the game in every phase of play, which has knock-on effects all the way down, right? If you're building up from the back, you're possessing the ball, so you're already, you're slowing down the game, you're looking to hold the ball, move it through the thirds, arrive in the final third in a repeatable and controlled manner so that you are more likely to have good possession and generate good chances. But equally, if you're kicking the ball long all the time, often what will happen is that you are just simply turning the ball over and then you have to go into your out-of-possession phase and you have to press well, etc. And, I mean, to be honest, Manchester United have been quite good out of possession largely this season. I think there's lots of caveats and questions that people talk about, but for me, Manchester United this season have been almost like a gegenpressing side, right, where they get the ball forward quickly, and a lot of their upside comes from their ability to, once the ball has been turned over, to either win the ball back immediately and counterattack, or force the ball into areas where they're going to be good at winning it back and then setting off Marcus Rashford in particular, or Antony and these channel runs where they can enjoy them as well. So at the moment, it seems to me that they have a style problem. The players that they have don't suit the sorts of style of play that you see elite teams adopting. That's not to say that all elite teams have the same style, and we've just put out a video about Real Madrid, who have a very different approach to the game than a lot of other elite teams, but the way that
a different way of being good,
have good players. But Manchester United, I think, are with Erik ten Hag definitely wanting to adopt that more controlled play style. They just simply don't have the players to do it right now, which raises the question: do you want a goalkeeper who's good at cross shot stopping, or do you want a goalkeeper who's going to be better in the build-up? And you can look at someone like Edison as a good example of someone who's the other type of profile to David De Gea. And we don't have these conversations all the time about Edison's shot stopping. So clearly it goes both ways. So
yeah,
I think it's if Manchester United is still playing David De Gea next season as a starting goalkeeper, they will not be challenging at the highest level.
No, I mean, it's also... I think in some ways, whilst it's important to recognise that David De Gea has been an excellent goalkeeper in his time, we are being a bit kind to him this season as well by saying that it's just a stylistic issue. He has made the joint most of any goalkeeper player leading to plays mistakes leading to errors leading to goals. Let me say all of that again. He's f***ed up 4 or 5 times, which have led to goals, right?
That's right.
And it's been very noticeable this season, and it's become a kind of topic, a regular topic of conversation. That's a bit different, Ruben, isn't it, from the stylistic issue? Do you think the stylistic issue is leading to those errors?
I'm not sure, but I do see this quite weird irony in his inability to play out with his feet, because the way he used to save loads of shots was with his feet. But his mistakes, they aren't just mistakes, are they? They're like quite embarrassingly comical mistakes sometimes.
They're
like
calamities.
There was, I can think of a few off the top of my head. There was the one at Watford, or against Watford, where he kind of threw the ball into the net by accident. There was one at Everton this year, or at Old Trafford against Everton this season, where he kind of ran into the post a little bit and then tried to close his legs and the ball went through it. And I think Cody might have scored. So it's and the save yesterday the goal that he conceded yesterday, he really should have saved. So if they were like sporadic mistakes that you can go, oh, that just happens, but it's the manner of them, which is quite alarming.
Well, and Steve Hanke made the point before we started recording that the other goalkeeper who is joint with him is Hugo Lloris. And I feel like it's kind of very noticeable, the sort of mistakes that Lloris has been.
They have
been
similar issues in build-up as well. Actually, they're very similar in their pros and cons. Yeah. Because like De Gea can kick a ball well. Like, he's not terrible, but their managers need them to be able to kind of drop it into like the perfect spot for a fullback to then, you know, take it on the kind of bounce and run with it, and just not panic when they have it. But the mistakes that we mentioned at the start of the season, like against Brentford, I feel like those weren't entirely his fault, were they? That was like, sure. Because I remember watching that game and trying to work out what United were trying to do, because he was clearly instructed, pass to Maguire, pass to Martinez, that's how we're going to play, and if it doesn't work, then we'll keep plugging away at it and whatever. But the rest of the team was like miles up the pitch. Yeah. So it was like, well, once they get the ball, who are they going to pass it to? So they have, as a team, got much better at avoiding those situations.
Sure.
But like John said, he's like used pragmatism in the true sense of the word, in that he's kind of gone, okay, well, this is what I've got, so I'm going to tweak my ideals. And I think with regards to like control, do you think Eriksen has been... I don't think Eriksen's been a bad signing. Do you think they've been a little bit... maybe they're disappointed that he isn't providing that control. Maybe they kind of misidentified what he would bring, because he's essentially a 10 who plays a bit deeper because he doesn't have as much legs anymore, right?
I think the big problem is that they have a squad that is set up to play a certain way, and then they brought in a manager and been like, we want you to start moving us towards this other way of playing. And that's obviously what happens at the beginning of the season. You try and build up from the back, and it leads to these calamitous errors. And so, as you say, Ten Hag adopts this pragmatism where he says, okay, well, we're going to avoid getting battered all the time in order to slowly move towards this ideal. But then, obviously, that's going the opposite way to where he was at the beginning of the season, which is, right, we're just going to throw ourselves in at the deep end, try and play that way.
That's the thing with elite clubs, though, isn't it? There's always this, like, base expectation of success that you can't really tear up a season and go, well, we're just going to implement everything new, and because if you drop out of like the top six, then it's a disaster in the eyes of the fans,
and then you move the manager on and you never actually make that step up. So again, a video that we've just put out this morning on the Illustrated channel, looking at the squad building issues that Manchester United have, I think that it's another example of the difficulty of the Manchester United job as a manager, that you're expected to, one, get the best out of a squad which isn't necessarily at the elite level that you want it to be at.
And contains Wout Weghorst.
whilst moving it to being a squad which does have those things. So what do? You bring in more better players, better technical ceilings for those players and profiles for those players, but you're putting them into a team where they don't. You have weak points. And at the highest level, if you have those weak points, opposition teams will exploit them. So it's a very, very tricky situation. So I don't think I would, to answer your question, which I sort of dodged around a little bit, but someone like Christian Eriksen obviously would be fine if you had the rest of that squad suiting that style of play. The problem is that he doesn't, and so Ten Hag doesn't have that, and so it makes it complexifies things.
Yeah, it's
a little
one thing
more,
having
so.
Good passes; they need other good passes to pass the ball to.
Yeah, it's worth shouting that video out. Actually, that was based on a conversation that happened on the Devils in the Details podcast, which is run by Aaron and Case, two Americans who talk about Manchester United in a very, very good way. I really enjoy that show. So you can go and have a listen to that and watch that video as well.
I think Aaron's Canadian, is he? Is technically American, right?
But... yeah, because they're North American.
Yeah, there we go.
I didn't say they were United Stateses. Yeah. I simply said they were Americans. And that could include coming all the way down from Tierra del Fuego. You know what I'm saying?
In case my claim to be Dutch as well.
Well, so you've maybe just offended both of them. He sounds American, though.
Okay, well,
I mean, he lives in North America.
He does.
And he sounds like an American.
Therefore,
he is American?
I think that's how it works.
Yeah. Okay, fine. Well, anyway, the Devils in the Details podcast. Do have a listen to that. Even if you're not a Manchester United fan, I think it's interesting for neutrals as well. Quick word on De Gea. This is from The Athletic on the 7th of May. United wanting De Gea to stay. Written by Laurie Whitwell. The 32-year-old's United contract is set to expire this summer, although the club have an option to trigger a one-year extension, and the manager emphasised his continued confidence in his goalkeeper, saying, "We want him to stay, and we want him to extend his contract. He has the most clean sheets in the Premier League, so we would not be in that position without him. He has fully has my belief, no concerns." That happens, blah, 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 blah. I mean, it's always kind of unclear whether that's real or not.
Yeah, there's a big clause in parentheses missing from Ten Hag's quote there, which is his internal monologue of saying, so we can get a fee for him and buy somebody better.
Potentially, although I would imagine that De Gea is probably unsellable based on his salary expectations.
On the fact that people may have watched him play football before.
Yeah. Well, anyway, let's see what happens with that. But if you were to replace him, John, just hypothetically, is there a goalkeeper out there that is gettable, that doesn't already play for an elite team, that would actually do a better job? Or is Ten Hag sort of thinking, fine, perhaps this isn't ideal, but there are other areas of the pitch that very clearly need to be strengthened as well, and we can't do it all in one summer? You know, is it the biggest issue, or is the bigger issue perhaps that, you know, through as a result of injuries and people not working out, you're currently playing Shaw as a centre-back, and Eriksen and Casemiro have a combined age of 155?
This is another conversation that they have in the Devils in the Details podcast, right? Because they're big on this idea that actually for elite teams, the most important thing is scoring goals rather than stopping them. So I think there's an argument to be made that you want to make sure that you've
got to buy a striker.
Yeah.
That's how they say it on the Devils in the Details podcast. Hey, guys, I'm from I'm Dutch, but I talk like this. And, you know, what are you going to know about Man United is they got to buy a striker, John McKenzie.
That's right.
Yeah.
But obviously, at the other end of the field, as we've been talking about, there is a long-term upshot from having a goalkeeper who can use his feet, right? It's not that you score more goals with a striker, therefore you should do that. Mm. Actually, that striker will score more goals if you have a goalkeeper who can use his feet as well.
It sounds ridiculous, but it's true.
It's a team sport.
Yeah, I think it's a Marcelo Bielsa quote that he said to Pep Guardiola, where he's like, if your team aren't scoring goals, you shouldn't be looking at the attackers, you should be looking at the defenders, because that's where the goals originate from.
Yeah, he really did a number on Pep, didn't he, that guy? He really
did a number on me, Joe.
He did a number on you. You were sort of broken for a while, weren't you?
I've remained broken ever since, but I maintain a brave face.
Yeah.
I sit here crying internally.
You're like a piece of pottery with lots of chips. You know, a charity shop wouldn't accept you if I took you in. And that's how
they'd be like, why is there so many chips in this pot?
Where are the missing pieces? I say they're with Marcelo.
Yeah.
He's got them in his pocket.
That's right.
Yeah, he's gone
in his bucket that he sits on. little bits of John.
Of my heart in that bucket. I mean, I'm sure there's a goal. I don't know anything about goalkeeping.
Just pick
I'll
one.
I'll be honest, but I can't.
Ilan Meslier.
No. I mean.
No, because you want to keep him, or no, because he's not the right sort of player. Isn't he quite similar to De Gea?
He's not good enough with his feet.
I mean,
I was kind of joking because they're the same. He's a younger version of De Gea and he's left-footed. He's a young version of Hugo Lloris.
But yeah, there's goalkeepers out there who are going to be good.
Who are they?
Just
pick one. What about René Higuita?
He's a bit old now, I think.
He's too old now?
David Seaman.
Do you want me to have a look on?
United have got Jack Butland on loan from Palace, so they could just keep him.
Yeah. Butters? Buttersworth? Mrs. Buttersworth. What's that from? What's Mrs. Buttersworth from?
No, Steve will know.
Steve's going to look it up. That's from something.
It's a brand of syrup. I'm sure it's other things, but probably Canadian or North American.
I should try and get us out of this sticky situation I've got us in, guys, shouldn't I?
Do you want me to tell you who has the best goalkeeping numbers in the top five leagues?
I do, but I want you to define what you mean by goalkeeping numbers first, because I thought they all played with number one.
Manuel Neuer's free, isn't he?
Well, is he not still injured from his broken thigh, femur?
Yeah, but he'll be better at some point.
Yeah.
Well, and you can't go skiing in Manchester.
Benjamin Lecomte is playing for Montpellier at the moment.
What a name, Benjamin Lecomte.
Alisson is the best goalkeeper according to post-shot expected goals.
He's not available though.
Okay. There's a guy called Yevan Diouf at Rennes.
Yevan Diouf. Okay.
He's currently saved his team around 9 goals this season, above expected.
You say, when you talk about Rennes, right?
No, it's Ram. Stade
Ram. Stade Ram.
That's the R-E-I-M-S one. Yeah. And you call them Ram.
Stade Ram.
Ram. Yeah, but
it's sort of like, sounds
you're rolling your R, though. It's not Spanish.
Yeah, I know, but he's doing that thing that people do where they pretend they know how to say it, but they just say it quite quickly and quietly.
With enough conviction.
If you say it slowly.
Literally all pronunciation is pretending you know how to say
it. Just say it slowly for us.
Stade Ram.
Ran. Are you ending with an N or an M?
If it sounds like an N, but it is an M-S.
Stade de Reims.
Yeah.
Stade de Reims. Can I say it like
Stade
that?
Stade de Reims. Are you happy now? Are you happy now
Stade
with
de
me?
Stade de Reims.
Stade de Reims.
Bernd Leno, good numbers this season.
Bernd Leno.
There's a guy called Frederic Renault at Union Berlin.
Union.
Another team who are overperforming their underlying numbers.
There he goes.
There seems to be a correlation here between teams who are defending above their levels and their goalkeepers.
There seems to be a correlation here between teams who are overperforming their underlying numbers and teams that John McKenzie mentions on a regular basis. Oh, there was a list of goalkeepers. Thanks for that, John. Thanks for listing off all those goalkeepers. Great. Let's talk about Liverpool now. They've got a good goalkeeper, haven't they? What are they? Big hands? Yeah?
That's
anyway,
right.
Liverpool 1-0 Brentford. Oh, Mo Salah goal, 13 minutes. They've won, I'm sure they may have won more, but I can only see their 5 recent fixtures, and they've won all 5 of them. Very impressive. As I said before, 1 point off Manchester United and 4th, 1 game more played. Very feasible that they could finish in the top 4. At least it's potentially possible. What the hell's happened here, Ruben?
They've just quietly started winning, haven't they?
Yeah.
So it's weird how the top 4 race every season seems to be who can mess up the fewest times, because every season it just feels like nobody actually wants to finish 4th.
It does feel like that, doesn't it? Yeah.
The nature of those teams is they're obviously going to be more inconsistent than the ones above them. So maybe I'm not actually observing anything, but like, you know, a team will get into 4th and then start losing like what United do. But yeah, Liverpool have just improved, haven't they? I wonder how much of that is down to their slight change in shape. You know, videos that John and JJ have done recently explaining kind of what Trent's role is kind of changed into. And I think, was there a stat on Sky Sports? There was a graphic. I'm not sure whether it's since that tactical tweak, but he's like top of every chart for all the positive creative stats. I don't have it in front of me, but I'm sure John's got it imprinted on his brain. So
well,
that might have helped him.
It's a relatively, you know, middling run in that they have 3 games left. They are away to Leicester. On the final day, they're away to Southampton, who I imagine will be relegated by that point. Tough second game, though, middle game there, because, of course, they are at home to the second best team in the league.
Yes.
Aston Villa. So you would expect, given that Liverpool are the 5th best team in the league, that they would lose that game just on the basis of expectations and how good each team is, John.
But the question is, are Liverpool really as good as everyone thinks they are right now?
I don't know, are they?
It's worth pondering, isn't it?
Yeah, if you want to upset
everyone. That's why we're here
again.
On the channel.
Yeah.
Well, Ruben's brought up the Trent Alexander-Arnold inversion that everyone's talking about. And, you know, I think there's obviously some positives to it. But I do think that people like it because Liverpool have started winning a bit more. And therefore, it's a good thing, right?
That is true.
Yeah,
and it's good when they win.
But the causality isn't always as tight as people like to think on these things. And I think when most other teams are doing it, they're doing it for a very specific reason, which is to overload in the central areas in order to be able to build through pressure. Mm. And I don't think Liverpool are doing that. Trent Alexander-Arnold is sitting a little bit deeper, and it's a way of having him in the centre of the field to move him up into that half space when they have possession of the ball in the final third. I think there's maybe also a defensive aspect to it as well. The idea being perhaps, and again, this is just me speculating, but obviously if he's playing high up the field, there's a turnover and they have to defend. Often he'll be way out of position and leave space that we'll have to, that he'll be tracking back into the fullback area. Mm. Whereas obviously now, from a more central position, if the ball is turned over and the opposition attack down his channel, what we're seeing now is the outside centre back on that side, usually Konate, pulling across and then Trent Alexander-Arnold dropping into the centre back spot a little bit more.
I assume that was the prime reason for the switch, was that so when they lost the ball, and because so many opposition teams just pump it down that channel because they know that Trent's going to be high up the pitch or unable to defend against their tricky winger. Mm. And Konate is more athletic and better at that type of defending. And the kind of the creative consequences of that move are kind of like a happy bonus.
Yeah, almost. I think you're probably right on that. But I suspect that what will happen is that it will lose its usefulness as other teams become used to being able to respond to it. Because I think obviously there's a lot of teams who invert their fullbacks now, but they usually do it for a very specific purpose. Whereas when Trent Alexander-Arnold does it, it looks quite different. He'll often sit outside the block, so you'll have a block of pressing players. Usually your inverted fullback goes inside that block to give another option to break lines of pressure. But Liverpool aren't really doing that so much. So there are games where he does get the ball to feet in a central area, and he's really, really good in those situations, right? There's no one better at ball striking probably in the Premier League, bar maybe Kevin De Bruyne or someone like that.
How old is he now?
Don't know.
Trent Alexander-Arnold. 24. Is he only 24?
Sounds like.
Wow. Can't wait for these sorts of conversations about how good he is to carry on forever for the rest of his career.
What do you mean, the sort of questions about how
good
he is? He's five months younger than me.
Right, well, okay.
And I'm a baby.
So he's 27.
Baby boy.
No, Arnold. Wait. I've got that completely wrong.
Because you're 27.
I am 27. I've forgotten.
So if he's 5 months younger,
I read his date of birth incorrectly. It says 1998, not 6. Right, so he's 2 years younger.
He's 25.
He was born in October 1998.
I don't know why you keep telling me that, as if that means you're asking me to do the maths, but saying it in a way
said he's 25. He's not 25 yet.
What is he?
24.
He's 24, like you said at the beginning of this whole bit.
Yeah, cut that little bit.
Listen.
Sorry.
I think we should keep that bit in. I enjoyed that.
I like it too, because we're working it out. We're working it out on the fly.
But Trent Alexander-Arnold is an interesting player because he's really good in possession and he's not as good out of possession. Football now, you have to be good in possession and out of possession.
And you know where else you've got to be good? In transition.
Yes.
Yeah, because that's not in or out, is it?
Are we going to transition into a new section now? Is this a really
not yet? Because I still wanted to talk about Trent Alexander-Arnold. Because I do think, you know, it's kind of clear what he's good at and not good at, right? But also it's also clear that the stuff he's not good at is, you know, the amount of detraction that would require of his value is significantly over fucking inflated in the general discourse, right? For a number of reasons. And I think that it's already resolved, but it will never be resolved and it will go on forever. The point I'm making is for the next, you know, 8 years until he's 32 and slows down and maybe stops playing, exactly the same conversation is just going to happen again and again and again and again.
I feel like the thing that people miss from the Trent debate most of the time is when they've talked about his like defensive deficiencies. When Liverpool were winning stuff, like, it didn't matter.
Yeah.
And he was a perfect fit for how they played. Mm-hmm. And not every right back plays the same way. Like, maybe they used to play more uniformly when everybody played 4-4-2. But now they all play very differently. So I think, like, I thought he has been brilliant for Liverpool, still is over the last, when did he break through? 2017 or something. So like 6-odd years. But there was always a very clear reason why he didn't play for England. Yeah. And I thought that was like kind of obvious.
I agree that the thing is that if he moves to team ever, we could then realise that so much of the problems that we attribute to him are actually problems with the way that Liverpool approach. There's no one who defends as aggressively as Liverpool.
No.
Particularly in terms of their back line, stepping up, committing players forward, and you know, almost relying on their midfield to stop those passes over the back being dangerous. And they're not doing that now. And so suddenly everyone's like, well, Alexander-Arnold's just a terrible defender, but he's always had the same defensive ability, and we never used to talk about
it. To paraphrase Paolo Maldini, if I have to defend, my teammates have made a mistake.
Yeah. Mm. And there's an element to which I think that's true. And I think in a different system where you're not necessarily defending so aggressively, he doesn't look too bad. I mean, I think some team like Newcastle rely on Kieran Trippier a lot.
Yeah.
And then they have Dan Burn usually on the other side. He does get forward, but you know, he's a bit more of a defensive fullback. I wonder if you were to play Trent Alexander-Arnold in that Newcastle team, whether or not people would have a different attitude.
Trippier's a really interesting one, though, isn't it? Because when he was at Spurs, he had the similar problems defensively to what Trent had, I think, in the sense that he was really good at whipping crosses in for Kane and Son to finish. But he used to get skinned by good wingers really often when he was at Spurs. Then he went to Atletico Madrid. Simeone taught him how to defend, came back, and now he doesn't get exposed.
I think the system again, though, because like under Pochettino, he's a coach who relies on his fullbacks to get forward to give width, and both fullbacks will get forward. It's the same with Liverpool. They've gone through that same process, right, of pushing their fullbacks forward.
Well, that was a fun and interesting conversation. Let's end it there. Oh, what a lovely break, wasn't that? Did you have fun? Nice break.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Good break. Yes, I'm now 3,679th in the queue.
Okay, that's about halfway, is it?
28 minutes left.
You're going to be buying your ticket while we're still recording. This is exciting. We can go through the whole process together. Is his laptop screen on show, Jamie? Yeah. Before you enter your card details, make sure that you're... Yeah. Make sure that you lean across there. Fine. Newcastle United 0-2 Arsenal. Now, this was a quite an exciting and thrilling game, wasn't it, baby boy?
It was. I really enjoyed how feisty this game was.
Yes.
It had real steel to it. The tackles were intense, the atmosphere was really, really loud, and it made for that kind of thing can make up for an occasional lack of quality. Well, for some people, I know John hates anything that isn't you know,
perfectly beautiful.
But I really enjoyed that side of it, and I thought Jorginho was particularly good.
Yeah.
And also think that's a brave decision for Arteta to play him instead of Partey.
Why did he play him instead of Partey? Was it just,
I think,
rotation?
Partey's just been playing quite badly with the ball recently, hasn't he? His build-up's been lacking a bit.
Oh, it's a bit tough when you're a footballer and you're not playing well with the ball, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the main thing you play with.
Yeah, whereas for all of like Jorginho's supposed flaws, he kind of masks them quite well and is a good ball progressor and actually is a good leader. I know he's quite a polarising player, but I thought against Newcastle he's particularly excellent.
Okay, what did you make of it, John?
Yeah, well, interesting. Now, I wanted to touch on this aspect of why Jorginho played, because when the game started, Newcastle came out of the blocks really hard. We knew that Newcastle were going to be intense in their pressing, one of the best teams at pressing, particularly high in the Premier League, and Arsenal are a team who like to build up from the back. And there were some interesting comments actually after the game from Arteta, who was talking about the way that Arsenal were able to move from the initial stages of the game, where I think when you go to a away stadium like St James's Park and you know that Newcastle are going to be really aggressive, you set up to maybe just get the ball forward quickly to avoid those really aggressive first 10, 15 minutes where you know the opposition are going to be very intense. But then you have to get back into the style of play that you want to be using throughout the game. I think that's why Jorginho was brought in, because he's a much better technical player than Partey in build-up phases. So you've got a player like that in the team who is going to be able to help realise those moments. But Arteta has talked about living in the game. I think this is a really interesting concept. There's been a few people talking about it on Twitter, but this is the idea that when you've gone through those first 15 minutes where you're not really going to try and impose your game plan so much in terms of, right, we're going to build up from the back. You've then got to go from that essentially being under the cosh a little bit from the first part of the game to then starting to try and control the game yourself. And it's hard to do in the game, I think, when you're having to face that intensity. So there was a phase of play where Arsenal actually started building up from the back, and they were able to move. There's, I think it's a 14 pass move where they move the ball around. It culminates with Martinelli actually getting a shot away. But I think that moment is something that Arteta touched on as well. Those moments are really important because it gives the rest of the team belief that the game plan can work. So he talks about it as living the game, right? You have the conceptual idea of how you want the game to go. But until you get onto the pitch and you start enacting it, there's always that worry that you might not be able to do that. But I've got some quotes from Arteta, actually from a loss against Newcastle last season, I think. Arteta said, sorry.
Oh, dear.
Sorry, Steve.
Is that a ticket update?
Yeah.
No.
What was the notification for?
A weekly planning meeting at 2:00.
Oh, it's a bank holiday. Don't worry about that one. Okay. That's fine. Yeah, I think also we're in the middle of a podcast, so if you want to send them an email and just say, I know it's a bank holiday, but I know you're not here anyway, but just let you know.
I think it's with you and JJ.
JJ's
off and you're here. So.
It's not. It explains why you've never attended that one historically, though. That's with all the editors.
Okay.
Yeah. You should probably go to it.
At 2:00? I thought that was at 4:00.
No, weekly planning meeting.
There at 3:00.
Look, 64 guests. Yeah.
Yep, never been to that one.
Good.
Anyway, getting back to the important matter of the football.
He's worked here for a year. Yeah.
Arteta was talking about this situation. He says, talking about living the game. Moving from the conceptual to the pitch itself.
Living the game.
So he says, it's how we deal with moments when we lose that control and we're able to reset and take the game into a direction that we want and finding a different way to do that. It's down to that. It's not about the leadership of the team. It's about the understanding of certain situations in the game, not to continue to put the game into that mood. So I think a lot of people have been talking about Jorginho in that respect because he is a player who can do that, who can, when things are really intense and you're... And
he's
you're
impervious to a bad mood.
Yeah,
he's always cheery. That's right. That's what you're saying.
Yeah,
he can't. He's not like someone who picks up on the energy. He just carries on.
He's kind of hyper alert, isn't he, at all times?
Mm. Yeah, and I think it's also having bravery, right, to try and build up through Newcastle's really aggressive press for that first time. I think, and it impacts the rest of the game, right? We saw it happen in the Liverpool game where Arsenal 2-0 up, Liverpool get a goal back, and then suddenly Arsenal just lose their nerve and they sit deeper and deeper. They allow Liverpool to progress the ball down the field easily and they're just bunkered up in their own box.
Well, it's scary. I mean, I was thinking just seconds ago about football. You know when you're a bad footballer and you've got ball comes to you and your back is to the opposition goal, you're facing your own goal and you know someone's running at your back. It's scary. And then I was thinking, even when you haven't got a football, you're not on a football pitch, if someone starts to chase you in a fun way, in a sort of playful way, it's scary. You get that little kick of adrenaline. I would straight away, I'd just boot the ball away, you know. So the idea of playing through that, remaining calm, being centred, very, very impressive, isn't it? They're better than me, the Premier League footballers, aren't they? They're better than me.
Particularly impressive when Fabian Scher is running around forearm smashing people.
That's true. Little shoulder to the face of Jesus there. Mm-hmm. Perhaps we'll come on to talk about, do all of the drama later, can't we? We can talk about the events, the dramatic events in the game, John.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about the dramatic events of the game.
Yeah?
I'm not some kind of robot. Oh.
Do you know how I know you're not a robot?
I literally watched the Notts County game with Ruben and I was very vociferous in that game.
Very emotive.
Because a robot would have attended that meeting at least once in a year. They would have known to do it.
Well, clearly it's had a big impact on the running of the company. So
that's true. It's worse because you're not there. Okay, fine. Well, very impressive stuff there from Arsenal to win 2-0 in tough and tight circumstances. Well done to them. Still 4 points behind, of course. they already ruined it a couple of weeks back. It's funny for everyone else. Now, let's talk about the game a little bit more. Referees in this game. Just one. Oh, I guess they had 4, technically. Maybe it's 5 now. There's the VAR as well. And then there's the VAR. There's a whole team of referees, not just one.
But this game was refereed in the way that you often see big games refereed now, big contentious games, where they sort of hold off showing the first yellow for quite a long time. I think Steve Hanke said it was 70 minutes or so before the first one came
73.
Out. 73 minutes, yeah. Worth interrupting for the
absolutely.
If only we had a running order which had this information on it.
Is it in there? I don't read what he writes down. But what do you think about that there?
What, the way this game was refereed?
Yeah, because it felt like there were a lot of quite bad tackles long before the 73rd minute.
Well, I said I liked how feisty it was, but refereeing, the prime aspect of that job is obviously to ensure that the laws are applied and followed, but also is to manage the spectacle. And I feel like fans quite often forget that. I once made a video about referees. They were training prison inmates to be referees so that they had something positive and productive to do afterwards and teach them the kind of skills that come with that, the personal side of it. And that was something that they really emphasized. You're constantly just managing situations. And it's all to do with like precedent, right? So if you book somebody really early, it can go one of two ways. Either players take note and go, okay, can't tackle like that, or we'll get booked. Or as would have possibly been the case in this game, you end up with at least one team getting a man sent off. So it's a very difficult job, but I thought generally it was refereed quite well. I don't remember thinking anything was outrageous. The handball call for that penalty was correct. Yep. Eventually took ages, but yeah. Maybe the Fabian Scher one was overlooked. But generally, I think it's fine for referees to take a slightly different approach if it's going to ensure a good, generally fair game and try and keep all 11 or 22 players on a pitch.
And this is your perspective, isn't it, John? Because you've said to me before that you don't think refereeing is about fairness. You literally said that to me.
I agree with what Ruben says, which is the primary reason that we have referees, of course, it is to make decisions about the rightness and wrongness of certain actions on the field. But the overarching reason why we have referees is so that two teams agree to play against each other in the first place. And again, as you've said, it's about managing a situation so that we can have a game which goes from start to finish and flows, right?
We played 11-a-side against the Telegraph on Friday.
Yes.
And we didn't have a referee. And it got a bit Did it really? There was no fights, but there were the honesty with which everyone agreed to play with at the start of the game, where if you fouled somebody, put your hands up, whatever, because that went out the window pretty in the second half.
Right. When things got tight.
That's why you need a referee.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the primary reason why you have a referee, like, because otherwise the game doesn't work. You don't have a game in the first place. Mm. And people have got sidetracked by the fact that they want to dot I's and cross T's on everything now, and they consider it to be massive injustice if something goes one way or the other. But the original reason for a referee was simply so the game can flow, and you accept within that context that sometimes a referee will make a mistake, and sometimes that mistake will go against you, etc. But I think initially the idea was, well, you know, That's just that happens.
All comes out in the wash.
But now we've introduced technology, and so refereeing has moved away from that original focus to more
about accuracy.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's a nice way of putting it, I guess.
Where are you in the queue?
Let's check that actually. Ooh. Ooh, getting there. 2,600. I was going to say the other way of refereeing is the one that maybe was used in the Super Clásico game yesterday, which is the game between River and Boca in Argentina, where six players were sent off.
Wow.
In that game. Although it was a big brawl at the end of the game rather than...
Yeah, it was all like 90 plus 10.
Yeah.
River scored a penalty late on, and then there was 7 minutes of fighting.
Yeah, I like it. I think I'd encourage more stricter refereeing and more fighting.
To quote you, you don't condone violence, but you do enjoy it.
Yeah, exactly. No, I don't condone it. You're absolutely right. But if, and just saying, hypothetically, if there were 5 or 6 or 10 games a season that were called off and cancelled due to the number of red cards exceeding the maximum possible allowance, I'd be fine with that. I'd be fine with that, yeah. Anyway, fine. That's it, isn't it? Cool. Bournemouth. FC Bournemouth 1-3 Chelsea. Very exciting for Chelsea. First win in 9, Ruben Pinder.
Bournemouth let the country down here.
I know,
we
what
wanted
a shame.
To see those 007 Lampard memes, but
they really did. But yeah, it's Lampard's first win. We'll come on to talk about that very, very shortly. But
even though they lost, John, Bournemouth have been terrific recently. They're not really part of the relegation battle in all earnest perspective.
I think they're pretty much safe, I think.
Yeah, I think so. They've done a terrific job. Gary O'Neill, specifically, done very, very well, hasn't he?
Yeah, and this is something we were talking about before we were recording, is that I think that there's a tendency for fans of clubs in the Premier League to judge the ability of a coach by where their team are in the league. And obviously, there's always going to be a situation where a coach ends up with a team who it's very unlikely that they're going to avoid relegation, or if they do so, it's an impressive result. But because no one is really raving about those sorts of teams, that those managers don't get the sort of what's the word, praise?
The praise,
yeah, recognition,
the credit,
that's it, recognition for what they've done. I think Gary O'Neill is a good example of that. Mm. Is that if you look at the squad, particularly before the January window, they did bring in some good players in the January window, but he's essentially taken a squad of players, accepted that those are the players he's going to have, and got them playing a system that works for them, and they've just been chipping away and getting the points that they need to stay up. And I think that's pretty impressive. And you know, it just because his team have overperformed is unfair there, but like exceeded expectations by staying in the league.
Yes,
doesn't mean to say that isn't any more of an overperformance than, you know, someone like Arteta getting his team challenging for a title. So,
sure, sure.
Yeah.
Well, it's quite an interesting point, isn't it? Because some other news came out yesterday, I believe, or the day before, which was that Vincent Kompany has signed a new contract with Burnley. And we've had a little discussion about whether that would be the right thing for him or not. There were definitely options elsewhere. It seemed as though he might have been on a short or long list for Tottenham. And as a result of him, the sort of football that he's played and the fact that he was a captain under Pep Guardiola, I think there's an excitement, a buzz around him as a coach. But he's decided to stay with Burnley for their promotion season and they'll move into the Premier League. What do you think of that decision, Ruben? Because that's kind of, if you had the option to go to a bigger club already, what do you think the positives of staying with Burnley are when it's going to be difficult for them next season, particularly with the style of football that they play?
Yeah, because quite often the team that plays the best football in the Championship and therefore gets promoted struggles the most out of the three promoted ones, and it's the more kind of gritty teams who play a bit more defensively.
Yeah. That, you can do that just with Norwich. Like the best Norwich promoted teams and get they go up smashed and down. In the Premier
but
League.
But then the ones who come through the playoffs and have to play a bit more defensively, then they're used to it, so they don't have to suddenly change everything. So it might be a struggle for them. I think from Kompany's point of view, it does make sense to continue with this project, because managers can end up in a big job too early, mm-hmm. right? And I think he ended up, correct me if I'm wrong, did he do quite well at Anderlecht once he stopped playing? Because he started off as like a player manager, didn't he?
Yeah, his time, and I don't know the ins and outs of it, but it was less impressive at the beginning for sure. Whether it turned around towards the end, I can't remember.
Doesn't he have a couple of City kids at Burnley as well? Are they going to be there again with him next season?
Oh, is
season
it like a Lampard situation, like when he had Mount and Tomori?
I genuinely don't know, but I heard someone say that there are a couple of young City loanees that were at Burnley last season, who may or may not.
Yeah, they had Jan Mattsson as well, who's a Chelsea player, but from what I believe, he's turned that team around. I think it would be unfair to say, I mean, obviously you need to have the players of the ability to play that sort of football, but
I don't mean he hasn't done a good job. I simply mean, like, will the stage be
generally,
like,
I think,
insurmountable?
Generally, I think it's good because doing badly at a massive team can like tank your reputation when things are out of your control. So when he does move up, he's going to want to pick the right move, and it will probably be a team who played a similar style between Burnley and City.
I think taking the next season and just considering it as if we can keep them in the league, playing the sort of football that I've been playing in the Championship, then it's only good for my career. It's just going to my stock will keep rising. Whereas, as Ruben says, if he goes elsewhere, you have that sort of situation where it's like, this is your one chance to impress people, and if it doesn't work out, then you sort of get resigned to the
unless you're Frank Lampard and you just get brought back a couple of years later.
Yeah, I don't think it's terrible for him to stay there, especially because the clubs that he's being linked to are the sorts of clubs where they've sort of been crisis clubs in the last few seasons,
like Spurs.
I would take the solidity
like
of
bottom half of the table.
I was thinking Spurs, like those are the big jobs that he might be considering leaving Burnley for. But I think you take Burnley, a club that you know, he spent a year there now. He's implemented a system. Everyone knows what's going on. The likelihood is that with another pre-season, they would improve at the things that they've been good at this season as well. Yeah. And they're playing a style of football which I think can do well in the Premier League.
Also, what's the rush? What's the rush? He's got ages. He's still young.
Plus, if you've watched The Bank of Dave, you know how lovely Burnley and the people of Burnley are because of in that film.
I haven't seen that film, but no. I have been to Burnley.
Yeah?
Fine.
It was fine. Yeah. To be honest, that's my reaction to everywhere in the UK. You go anywhere and you go, yeah.
Just a town, isn't
it? It's fine.
Yeah. Some places are nicer than others, I would say.
I spent the weekend with Steve Hankey, hand in hand in Cambridge, weren't we?
Cambridge is a nice city.
Yeah, it is nice. But then also...
It rained, did you say?
It's got something about it, hasn't it? It's got a... Look, it's like, look at me, this is lovely. It's got just look, though. Don't you touch me. Don't move here. Don't you touch. Come and visit. Go to the Raymond Riggs exhibition. But if you touch anything.
Yeah, bitte nicht auf Rasen treten or whatever it's.
That's right, John. Yeah.
Yeah, what he said. Yeah. It's got a stench of elitism.
Bitte nicht auf
it?
Dem Rasen treten. Before the Germans hate me.
What does that mean?
It means don't stand on the grass, right? Right. Don't step on the grass.
Why are you saying that in German? Is there a reference to that?
Because it's on all of the lawns in Cambridge.
They write it in German.
Because it's tourists who are going there, isn't it? They have it in other languages.
Predominantly German tourists that visit Cambridge.
No, it's predominantly German tourists who stand on the grass.
Germans always standing on grass, aren't they? Always standing on grass.
They
the
love
Germans.
Rasenballsport, of course, don't they? People of Leipzig. They're big lawn ball sport fans.
They love being on the lawn.
Yeah, so they have to put these signs up to keep them off.
Yeah. No, Cambridge is nice. Where's the best place that's not London?
Well, with that caveat.
I mean, obviously, that's not.
You two are such Londoners, aren't you?
Where else are you supposed to go?
I hate going.
Listen, do you know what? If anyone's listening to this who thinks that because we like living in London and it's good here that we're out of touch, then you can fuck off and go and live in a small village.
The correct answer is Bristol.
That was the correct answer 10 years ago when everyone said it was.
Do I just say that? Well, I have family in Bristol, so I like it.
Which family? How related are you to that?
As in, like, my mum's stepsisters.
Okay.
No, they're not Pinders, actually.
Fine, they're not Pinders. Fine. I think it might be Norwich.
I've never been to Norwich.
Norwich is lovely.
Yeah, it is good in Norwich. Norwich is basically Cambridge, but you're allowed to touch wherever you want.
It's true.
I went to Oxford once on a shoot. That was quite nice.
Yeah?
Yeah. But again, same problem as Cambridge.
I didn't like it there because the pavements were heaving. Mm. And I was quite furious narrow. With how slow everyone was walking. And I was having a whole day argument with my wife. It was a whole bad day. The whole day was bad. What about you, John? You lived in Edinburgh for a while, didn't you?
I lived in St Andrews in Scotland for a while.
Yeah.
Edinburgh is a lovely place as well. Mm. I really like Edinburgh. St Andrews is lovely too, although a little bit remote.
Right.
I think a bit too far away. It was nice when I was an undergrad, but...
Went to Liverpool on a stag do in November. That was Liverpool's really nice.
Liverpool's a good place.
Yeah, I love Liverpool.
Yeah, I like Liverpool.
Good people.
Mm-hmm. Do you know, I went last year? Doesn't matter. Went to the town of Glastonbury. Not to the festival, but to the town of Glastonbury. And there were two shops that I literally couldn't stay in for longer than a couple of seconds on account of how strong the smell of incense was inside, you know. Because for people who don't know, Glastonbury, you will have heard the festival, Glastonbury, but there's a town nearby. Glastonbury Festival, it's not actually in Glastonbury, it's just nearby. But it's quite a, what would you call it, a new age town?
Glastonbury Tor, right?
Glastonbury Tor, yeah.
It's the hill.
Which is great. I stood on top of the hill, climbed up the tor, looked down, meadows, green meadows everywhere. And the wind was such that it appeared that there was a sea of green around the tor. That was nice.
That was beautiful.
Yeah, pretty cool. But then there were a lot of crystals around. So, you know, ups and downs, isn't it?
I went to the Lake District on my annual leave. That was nice.
Yes, you had fun.
Yeah, I did a bit of walking, a bit of boating, you know, lots of saunas.
Did you go boating on your own?
Yeah.
Yeah. What does that mean though? How does one go boating on their own?
I went
sailing,
on a boat.
Rowing?
Well, it was a boat captained
by someone other than you?
Yeah.
Okay. You were a passenger on a boat.
Yes.
Yeah. And what form does the boat take? A steamer.
Mm, really? Went down Windermere on the boat.
Oh, lovely. That's very nice.
It's not London though, is it?
It's not London.
No, it's no Pret up there.
You can't get Pret. You can't order a burrito in the middle of the night, John.
Pret.
Huh?
Oh, yeah, that's true.
The Windermere Pret.
One thing I will say for London is that there is a good source of burritos after 11 p.m. at night.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. Oh, and I should shout out as well, I should say, to, speaking of Cambridge and Pret, hello to Maverick, who I spoke to in the Cambridge Pret a Manger, one of many in Cambridge. Not Maverick, Pret's, you know. But, yeah.
Is that their name?
His name was Maverick.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Is that like a gamer tag?
I think it was his actual name. Weird. He's a Cambridge student. They've all got weird names. My cousin went to Oxford, and she said on the first day she met a boy called Merlin who had a bird with him. And I said, have you gone to Hogwarts? And she said, you're the fifth person to make that joke. And I got bad about myself. Anyway, fine. Let's move on. Oh, we're supposed to talk about is it break?
Break, please, yeah. First.
Break. Let's talk about the semi-finals of the Champions League now, because they, of course, start. And before we finish talking about the Premier League, we should say we're recording on a Monday, bank holiday Monday here, on account of the King, on his account. But anyway, what I was saying was there are three Premier League games today that are all sort of, you know, relevant to the relegation battle that we do not know the result of, and you will know while you're listening. So we're moving on, not talking about the relegation. We'll talk about that next week instead. We're going to discuss the Champions League. Ah, on the European continent, of course, where there are two large round games of football, Ruben and John. One of them being Real Madrid, Manchester City. The other being the Milan Derby. Now, Tuesday is City Madrid taking place in Manchester. I feel like we have some idea of what to expect from this, but what are you expecting, Ruben, baby boy Pinder?
I don't think I'm expecting Pep to overthink it again. I think I just said the word think quite a lot. He's settled into a system now, so you know what you're going to get with City. I'd be interested to see who he chooses in the back two lines, like the defence and then the kind of pivot positions. But City will have most of the ball. Grealish and Bernardo Silva will start wide. They will try to work it into Haaland, and Real Madrid will look like they're going to lose 5-0 all game and then inexplicably win because Luka Modric exists.
It's not a terrible prediction, John.
It's not, no. We just made a video looking at whether or not Real Madrid can keep getting away with it, in the words of the meme. But
and by getting away with it, you mean that they just win when they look like they shouldn't?
Yeah, the idea is that actually, because we expect elite teams, we talked about this before, elite teams to play in a certain way, and Real Madrid don't necessarily play in that way, that therefore they are undeserving of these victories when actually they have good players who they are able to
link rely to, on.
Yeah, rely on, but linked also play together in a very sort of visceral way rather than in an overly cerebral tactical way, and it works.
Yeah.
In that video, we talked a little bit about the out of possession stuff being maybe the bit that will hold Real Madrid back, and that's because, again, we were talking about with Manchester United before, it's all about control. If you can't control the out of phase possession, the out of possession phases of the game, then you make your life a lot harder. But Madrid still seem to manage to be able to do it.
So controlling the out of phase possession would be very complicated. It's sort of sci-fi football thing there, isn't it? Where it's kind of glitching in and out of existence.
Yeah. All of those trophies Real Madrid have won, it kind of plays into this question that nobody can really answer. Like, you guys have done video on this as well. It's like, what does Ancelotti actually do?
Yeah.
How good is he? How good was Zidane? Like, would Zidane be good anywhere else? Because they're more, especially Ancelotti. Actually, no, Zidane, like, the both of them, they're like ego whisperers. Like, they had all these superstars and they just kept them all happy.
That's
and
right.
I remember when Zidane...
They're environment scientists.
Yeah, when... Yeah. when 16-17, I want to say, when they won it in Cardiff.
Mm-hmm.
I think the league had gone, like Barcelona were winning the league. So they kind of sacked it off and were playing like James and Morata, and they were making like 7-8 changes for league games and prioritising Champions League.
Yeah.
And I think there are very few people who can convince players like Benzema and Ronaldo and Modric that that's good for them.
Mm.
But Zidane and Ancelotti, they command this respect, and obviously they know what they're doing, but it's a different approach, isn't it? They're not wedded to a tactical philosophy, and that makes Real Madrid's success harder to explain.
Yeah.
But I find it really interesting. Like, I think last season, Ancelotti kept on throwing Rodrigo on as a sub, didn't he? And winning these games in the Champions League got quite late on. But he was also Like he'd take Kroos off and maybe put Camavinga on. That was one of his repeated subs as well. And then he would use Kroos as like an assistant manager. He kept on asking, well, I say kept on. There was a moment where he asked him, like, what do you think we should do? And to have that kind of trust in your experienced players is really rare.
Yeah, it's super, super interesting. I mean, I think even given how good Manchester City are as a team at the moment, it says something that it's very clearly not a foregone conclusion this
year.
Yeah,
I mean, I think they're favourites, aren't they? But
well, what do you think? I mean, who would be your prediction for going through to the final?
I think City will go through because last season this tie was incredible when they met, but Benzema was like on absolute fire.
Mm.
On absolute fire.
He was on fire.
He was absolutely on fire.
He was absolutely on fire. He had to be doused regularly.
On absolute fire.
To avoid overheating.
And this season he's not quite been putting up the same kind of numbers.
No. He's just crackling.
But he's still a great foil for Vinicius. And goals are coming from other players.
Mm.
Rodrigo starting a bit more. Valverde's coming to midfield. I do think City will win though. I just think they've got a little bit too much control.
I've got a quote here from Ancelotti, who says, talking about his midfielders, this is when they had Casemiro. He says, the key for all three is the experience of playing together for so many years. Then there are things like the position changes they make in matches. Sometimes Tony or Luca go down to get out of the pressure. Casemiro goes up. I'm not going to get involved. Real Madrid can rest easy. I'm not going to get involved there. So he's just sort of letting them vibe out.
Yeah.
But anyway, I've finally got through the queue, so I'm going to ignore you.
Okay, so now tell us what's happening. Where are you? You're in the website. The Wembley website, presumably.
Yes.
Yeah. Is it wembley.com?
I don't know.
Read the whole URL.
Login.thefa.com.
Okay, fine. And what are you doing? You're purchasing one ticket, two tickets?
I'll probably buy a couple and see if someone wants to come.
Oh, how sad. Oh, no. You don't have a fill for the second yet, but you are going to buy it. Who else are you going to offer it to? Can you give us a list of
They only won the game yesterday, so it's not. I've not had a huge amount of time to like.
No. Yeah, of course. All of your friends you're making it just sound don't like know I yet. Just... And who will you invite? What do you think?
I've invited a couple of friends who are Leeds fans because my friend who works for the club is a Leeds fan as well. So there's been a few of us keeping an eye on it. But Leeds are also playing a big game against Newcastle.
What about JJ? Do you think he'd go with you?
Maybe you could invite Henry. Yeah, Henry can't go because he hates me.
What about your dad? Would your dad come down for the day?
No.
Mummy?
No.
No?
My dad might go with you.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
What about Mr. Pinder?
I met Daddy Boy Pinder.
Did you?
Yeah.
You met Daddy Pinder?
Yeah.
Holy shit. How old is he?
30. In his 30s, I think.
Yeah. I think it'll be a 1-0. I think City will play really well, but Real Madrid will come back into it in the second half. Man City will win 1-0, and then you'll go to Madrid a week later and think, that actually is not very big, And then Man City will win 5-1, right? And they'll just smash them in Madrid. I can feel it.
What's your favourite Pep overthinking moment?
Is it when
he played no defensive midfielder in the final against Chelsea?
Yeah, that was good.
Played, I think, De Bruyne up top.
Yeah.
Or was it when he went with a back five against Lyon and played Eric Garcia, who is not very good at that level?
See, he says he doesn't overthink, though, doesn't he?
He does. He has, though.
It's like one of the things
Rodri.
He does.
Like, that season they got to the final when they played Chelsea and lost to that Havertz goal.
Mm.
They'd been playing 4-4-2 with Rodri and Gundogan as this like brilliant double pivot, Foden and Mara stretching the pitch, and De Bruyne and Bernardo Silva as like two false nines who just kind of came and went and like, you know, instinctively moved off each other.
Yeah.
And then he tore it all up and dropped Rodri for the final and put Gundogan deep, and it just didn't work. And
this'll surprise him.
Yeah.
I'll do something worse.
I think it was because he wanted to like shoehorn Sterling into the team and James kept him quiet, but I don't think he's going to do it again.
He's got your tickets.
Yeah.
Put your arms up again so Jamie can swap the cameras to you. There he goes.
Come on, the Notts County.
Yes.
There was another one when he was at Bayern and they were playing Luis Enrique's Barca. And I think he went back three, man for man, against Neymar, Suarez, Messi. And that was when Messi put Boateng down. But I don't think he's going to do that again.
You don't think he's going to do that again?
No.
Okay, well, we'll find out. We'll find out, won't we?
Did we decide who is going to win? Man City.
I think we've agreed it's going to be Man City.
Do you know people hate the way I say Man City?
Yeah, because you say it like an American. You say it like Rory Stewart would say it.
Man City. How do you say it again?
Man City.
No,
no, that's not how you
say it. I say Man City. I say Man City when I'm saying it.
Man City, dude.
Man City. Oh, because it's the city. City with like a D.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying. Say it again.
Man City.
Yeah, you do sound... I've never noticed that before. Do you sound American when you say anything else?
No.
Say, can I have a bottle of water?
I would like, please, a bottle of water.
Nice. Water, that's not bad. Very good. That's pretty good, yeah. And now do...
I did not know that.
One more game we have to talk about is Milan. Is Milan. The Milan Derby. Both of the Milans are playing each other in a two-legged semi-final tie for the Champions League. Very old-fashioned, isn't it? Yeah. And this could be potentially the most boring game of all time, John.
Well, yeah, I think boring depends what you like, right?
I like boring
horses
word.
For courses. But yes, word? I think there's a supposition that this game could be quite tetchy. Both teams have got a fair way through this competition by being solid defensively. And I guess when you bring the immovable object against the immovable object, or whatever this saying is it may not lead to the greatest football.
But it was the unstoppable force versus the immovable object.
Yeah, but they're both immovable objects rather than unstoppable forces. Right. Isn't an unstoppable force more like...
Well, I guess the issue is if you had two unmovable objects, unless they were always touching, they could never touch.
Well, yes, but isn't that what we're trying to say? That this
his analogy works
games?
Perfectly. Yeah.
That they can't touch.
Yeah, the problem here is you, not the analogy.
Well, no, because the thing is the force comes to touch the object
yes.
And that's the friction is when
so that's
the thing
why it's
occurs.
Exciting because you're like, oh, there's a really good defensive team against a really good attacking team.
But your analogy doesn't work because if you have two unmovable objects,
that's why he called them both immovable objects.
I know, I understand, follow my logic, baby boy. If you have two unmovable objects, right, the suggestion would immovable. Be that when immovable, how dare you, when the force isn't moving towards the object, they're not playing in a game of football, right? They're not, the friction, it only happens when they touch. But if you have two immovable objects, you can't ever move them closer to each other unless they're constantly touching.
Yeah.
Because they can't ever move.
Yeah.
So they couldn't be having a game of football.
No.
So it's not the perfect analogy.
I still
analogy.
Think the analogy works. I love the fact that in this game we've got Edin Dzeko and Olivier Giroud leading the line of each respective team in a Champions League semi-final.
That is nice.
Having, you know, after the Premier League's elite deemed them not good enough anymore a few years ago.
It's like a 2015 headline.
Milan are a team who do like to, they're a very pressy team, and they like to, I guess, win the ball back and then attack at speed, which is quite fun when they have Teo Hernandez and Rafael Leao, but Rafael Leao is not available, I believe, for the
Did
first
leg.
Did you see
Hernandez's goal the other day?
Yeah,
ran. He dribbled with the ball from his own box to the other box, and then just slapped it top bins from like 20 yards. It was amazing.
Milan have two sources of ball progression. One of them is called Teo Hernandez.
Yeah,
and one
he
of
just
them is
he loves that
Rafael,
inward run, doesn't he?
Yeah, the two of them together is just.
So they've only got one for the first leg.
Yeah, so that will probably be an issue for them. And Milan Inter under. Inzaghi have sort of always promised to be quite good, but never really really achieved it. And so, yeah, it does have the feeling of a game where, if I were to use an analogy, I'd say it's an...
now, be careful what you say.
I'd say it's an immovable object against an immovable object, and it won't make for a good game because the two immovable objects will be at other ends of the pitch. They never touch.
They
and
couldn't
so it
have
be boring.
A game. Yeah.
Because you need them to touch in order
for the
for
game
to
even
be,
happen.
Yeah, for it to be fun, yeah.
Right. Inter Milan have done... Inzaghi's done something relatively interesting tactically at Inter Milan, though, with, in the sense that he's taken players who I always thought of as attacking players and started playing them deeper. Like Hakan Çalhanoğlu, formerly of AC Milan, is playing as like a six now, I think, sometimes. As like deep lying playmaker, picking the ball up from the back three. Henrik Mkhitaryan, who was like a 10 or a winger, he's now playing as an eight in that same midfield. Mm. So I just thought that was quite interesting, the way they can move further back the pitch as they go. I suppose a lot of players do that. I never
don't talk yourself out of it. It was interesting. You got towards the end, and then me or John didn't.
It.
We didn't go, yeah. And then you lost confidence in what you were saying, but I thought it was good.
Thanks. Çalhanoğlu also scored a banger recently.
Yeah.
I just love a goal that goes top bins.
Top bins means in the top corner, Joe.
Right. How do you get it in there, though, if it doesn't move? Hey, my screen's gone dead. I need the screen. Okay. Who's going to win that one then? Impossible to say.
Yeah, I think
nil-nil.
Nominally,
nil,
it's
nil.
The most interesting game, right? Because, well,
yeah, for people like
you know, Well, no. No,
for a certain type.
I will very much enjoy the City game against Real Madrid.
I think you'll find that it's actually the Milan derby that's the one that's most interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they are both equally interesting, but I think...
Which one are you going to watch? Oh, they're on at different times.
Yeah. Okay.
Both. Which one are you going to watch?
If they were on at the same time, which one would you watch?
I'd probably watch the City game, yeah. Right. Because, you know, it's the sort of culmination of this Man City team, right? This is this is arguably the best team that Pep's had.
It's a 17-year long narrative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, regardless of what you think of Man City and how they, and you know, everything surrounding them.
The sports washing.
That stuff.
Yeah.
And the other stuff.
Yeah. That's a real drag,
That's a JFK quote, isn't it? It's like, oh, we will get to the moon and then do all the other things.
Yeah.
I played with Milan on FIFA yesterday and they are really fun to play with.
They're fun on FIFA.
I won, yeah. So
yeah. Okay.
I reckon they'll probably win.
We've got the youth vote for Milan. The old vote says...
Yeah, no, I think both of those teams could do it and it'll be one that we see...
I think both teams could win as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not at the same time. Let's just be clear. Both teams can't win because only one team can win.
That's right.
Because but one like of them theoretically, before the game begins, both teams could theoretically win.
That's true.
But again, not at the same time.
Not at the same
time. And that's your punditry.
Well, let me flesh it out, Joe.
Please do.
I was
add
using,
more flesh
I was
to the
using
bone.
A sleight of hand, a linguistic sleight of hand,
right.
Which was,
yeah.
You know, to...
You're being
Lytoti or something. Was Lytoti, is that understatement? I can't remember.
Yeah.
Anyway,
everyone
nice
knows
word.
What that
it's
means.
It's a nice word to say, isn't it? Lytoti.
Lytoti, yeah.
But I think that game very much hinges on what happens as the game ebbs and flows, whereas with the Man City... the Man City... Real Madrid one, as you've said already, we know how that's going to
happen. It's predetermined.
Flow, we know that Man City are going to dominate possession,
of course.
And so to a degree, that will be a fun game to watch.
Yeah.
But if it unfolds the way that we expect it to unfold, it will be fairly. Whereas with Milan and
anything
Inter,
could happen.
I think the first team to score that changes then the whole tenor of
that would change. Yeah,
because they'd be 1-0 up.
Game state.
You're right, because then
game
it forces
state.
a naturally defensive team
yeah,
to
exactly.
come out. And,
yeah, exactly. So
I agree.
The team that scores first will then try and sit on their lead and then pick them off on the break.
I completely agree with that. I also think what happens in the game will affect the outcome of the game.
Yeah.
Lytoti's, Steve has dropped it in the chat here. Ironic understatement in which an affirmative is expressed by the negative of its contrary. I don't even know what that means.
Oh, okay. So it's like...
E.g., I shan't be sorry, for I shall be glad.
Yeah.
Yeah?
That's what I was doing there.
Right.
I was using understatement.
Cool. Cool stuff.
I shan't be sorry when this podcast is over.
No. Fair enough. Well, there's one more thing you have to do before the podcast is over, and that's listen to me read a lot of things that Steve wrote down for me to say. Okay? You ready? Because League One final day summary then, rap, -1:17 recorded,
not
and we need to
bit.
Do the intro too. Oh, shit. Shit, okay, yeah. Okay. how does it start with however?
You start with the bit before.
Oh,
that.
Yes. League Two and the Championship end on Monday. Is that today?
That is today.
They end today. Mm. Do they really?
As we've recorded, Northampton Town have been promoted to
Northampton
League Two.
Town.
So congratulations to the Cobblers. And
well
fans.
Done to the Cobblers. Where's me shoes? That's what they
Not
say,
to
isn't
League
it?
Two,
That's
surely.
Their big chant. Where's me
Sorry,
shoes?
Sorry, League One yeah. from League
we
Two.
We scored a goal. Where's me shoes? Remember that one? Remember that one they had? What about the shoes? You know, and then boots, boots, boots. Remember that one? The Cobblers? What other chants did they have? You know?
Oh, these are real. You're not making them up. These are real.
Yeah,
oh.
yeah, they're all real. Yeah, all their shoe-related chants. Leather, leather, leather shoes. They had that one, didn't they? Oh, the Cobblers. Anyway, well done to the Cobblers. Very happy for the Cobblers. League Two in the Championship end on Monday after. Sorry. The point is they end, and we can't talk about them because we haven't recorded yet, but we are talking about it. It's very confusing. However, former Everton midfielder Stephen Schumacher, is that right?
John's lost it. He plays for the Cobblers as well.
And his name means shoemaker.
That's
managed Plymouth to League One. He's managed Plymouth.
You made that up. I refuse to believe
Steven
this.
Schumacher.
He's leather shoes.
He's won it. There you go, Steven. Congratulations to Steven Schumacher. The Pilgrims will be in the championship next season.
No,
that's
please,
right.
No
They're making
chance.
The pilgrimage up the pyramid there. There we go.
Have you got any Plymouth chants for us?
Yeah. Well, the Mayfeather weather. What was that boat called? The Pilgrims
Mayflower.
Boat. The Mayflower. Got the bird. Anyway, Ipswich Town, managed by former Man United assistant manager Kieran McKenna, will join them in the championship after the Tractor Boys ploughed their way to 98 points and second place. 98 points, only good enough for second place in League
Argyle
One.
Argyle got 101.
Incredible. And Argyle,
Notts County,
the scythes. Yeah?
Notts County got 107, didn't they? Or was it?
Very impressive.
108, 107.
Yeah. Over 100, wow. The team's down there really getting some points. One of Sheffield Wednesday, Barnsley, Bolton Wanderers and Peterborough United will go up via the playoffs. That's very exciting. Peterborough, a.k.a. The Posh, learning a lot of nicknames here.
They used to have a guy who walked around a stadium in like a top hat with like a monocle and a three-piece suit.
Very
like
nice. Yeah. I can see why they would be called The Posh. You've explained the etymology for me. Pipped. Where did I get to?
The Posh.
Pipped. By Derby County to the final
playoffs. To the final.
Pipped,
active, not
passive. Pipped Derby County. They weren't pipped by. Not like a fruit. They pipped Derby County to the final playoff place on the last day of the season. I don't even know what league we're talking about anymore. Is it one or championship?
One.
League One. Derby County are in League One, are they? Good
yes.
Lord.
You know, Jeff Stelling is standing down at the end of the season.
Is there?
I genuinely think you should go for it.
It'd be a different sort
Can
of
you
show,
imagine?
Wouldn't it?
Oh, I think
different
you'd be
sort
the
of
perfect
show.
Jeff Stelling.
Hold on, let me. In the relegation places, MK Dons went from the finishing 1 point off automatic promotion last season to the relegation this season. What about that, Cammy?
That's yeah. Fucking good.
Not but bad, for who?
Chris?
Oh!
Clive? George?
Oh!
Who is it?
Yeah.
Clive.
I don't know. Cambridge United survived on the final day of the season by winning 2-0 at already relegated Forest Green Rovers at the Abbey. The Abbey. Yes. Forest Green are managed by Duncan Ferguson, .. Now, I don't understand the significance of that ellipsis.
I think the implication
because he's someone
is,
you've heard of.
Oh, I've heard of him.
Have also, you? Try I've telling Duncan Ferguson that he's been relegated.
Right. Like, he doesn't like it.
No.
He wouldn't like to hear that.
No, he might
no
go
fair
his
enough.
Golf clubs.
Morecambe, this is interesting, Reuben. Morecambe and Accrington Stanley join MK Dons and Forest Green Rovers in relegation to League Two, where they will play Wrexham next season. Yes.
Accrington Stanley. Who are they?
Who are they? They're from Stanley, aren't they? That's where they're from.
That's
hey?
Right.
Hey, good joke. I know they're not from Stanley. Anyway, I think that's the end, is it? Is that the end, Steve?
I hope so.
Okay, you've written here, okay, that's enough for this episode. Say your goodbyes. Well, in which case I will say thank you to the
it's quite
most...
chilling when you say that, isn't it? That's the end of the episode, say your goodbyes.
Well, there are only
five.
Five studio ones left.
So, yeah, the big time goodbyes coming soon to the most delightful little baby boy of all time. It's Ruben the baby boy Pinder. Thank you.
Gaga.
Oh, look at
you. Do you know that Ruben the baby boy Pinder's father calls him Ruben the baby boy Pinder?
Does he?
This is another thing that
Does he actually?
I never recounted that story, did I?
No, he frequently brings the joke up, but if he's trying to get my attention, he won't go, baby boy.
I'm going to make it my life's work for that to be the case. But
so what did you meet?
I went to Shea Pinder. It was great.
What's that?
I needed a drill.
Shea Pinder. Oh,
yeah.
You mean the house of the home of Pinder?
Yeah, the Pinder Palace.
Pinder.
I see what you're saying. Right.
I've got like a rail to hang in my bedroom to put my shirts on.
Yeah.
Because, I was just being more economical with space.
Right.
But I didn't have a drill and I didn't want to buy a drill just to put up a thing. So I was like, Ruben lives very close to me. So I thought, I'll see if he has one. And his dad had a drill.
His father had a drill.
And lent me the drill, yes. And
you used it?
I used it, but it didn't work at first. And then I looked at the plug and the wires were all hanging out. Oh, yeah. So I rewired the plug. It's now much more
of the drill.
That's really impressive. I wouldn't know where to start.
I rewired the plug of the drill.
How do you not have a drill if you know how to rewire a plug?
Because the knowledge of rewiring a plug doesn't necessarily require the owning of a drill.
Good Lord.
I'm glad I can explain that one to you.
Oh my God.
It was good. All good fun. But
great
yeah,
stuff. What's it like at the Pinder Palace?
Yeah, it was a lovely little place in.
Yeah.
I'm not going to
said little three times. Sounds like he's really trying to emphasize how little it is.
Our house not big enough for you.
Is it because on account of how small he is? What's his bedroom like? Does he sleep in a cot?
Yeah. I didn't go into his bedroom.
Because sometimes I worry about if he could get out of bed on his own at night, what would he do? You know, he does need those little walls around him to keep him safe. Yeah. All precious and safe. Yeah. Anyway, thanks for today.
You're very welcome.
Yeah. And Jonathan Dog McKenzie? There he goes. Well, there we go. Thanks to Steve Hankey, producer Hankles.
No worries. You're welcome.
And thank you to our long-limbed friend, Jamie, the video producer. There he is, way big old waves.
I like how Steve says no worries, even though every episode is filled with many worries.
Yeah, for Steve specifically, yeah. How long do you think this one's going to take you to edit?
Oh, like, you won't hear it till Friday, I think.
And it's getting worse every week we get towards the end, almost as though there's nothing worth, you know, protecting. Or there's no incentive to do a good job.
Just all of our reputations.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Well, we'll be back next week, or will we, with more, where I believe JJ Ball rejoins us. And actually, I think we've got a special guest in the studio. Am I thinking correctly?
Did
he say that he was? Yeah, I believe Seb Stafford-Bloor is going to be here next week in the flesh. That's very exciting.
I haven't met him yet. That'd be nice.
Have you not met Seb yet? You'll get to clasp his hand. He's a hugger.
He's a hugger. He'll hug you.
Okay.
He's
a hugger. I'm a hugger.
Yeah, good. You can hug each other. We'll be back then.
It won't be like the immovable object hugging the immovable object. Am I right, Joe? Yeah,
I could come back at you, but I feel like Steve's boring his eye holes into my head to say that's the end of the show. Ta-ra, auf Wiedersehen and bienvenue.
The Athletic.